Okay, we're going to go right into lecture number 16, and this is we're trying to cover two books during this time, Ecclesiastes by Solomon and the Song of Solomon by King Solomon as well. Introduction to Ecclesiastes. It is probably the most philosophical book in the Bible. Job deals with the problem of evil. That's very philosophical, but this is probably even more philosophical. Proverbs is very philosophical because it deals with wisdom. But again, this is even more philosophical than that. So Ecclesiastes, probably the most philosophical book in the Bible. It was written by King Solomon. Look at Ecclesiastes. By the way, don't confuse it with Ecclesiasticus, a book that doesn't belong in the Bible. It's found in Catholic Bibles. But look at verse 1 of chapter 1 of Ecclesiastes. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Well, what son of David ruled as king of Jerusalem? Solomon. Verse 16. I said to myself, behold, I have magnified and increased wisdom more than all who were over Jerusalem before me, and my mind has observed the wealth of wisdom and knowledge. That fits Solomon. We know from 1 Kings 4:29 to 34 and 1 Kings 10:1 to 6, he had a reputation of being the wisest man alive, and people traveled from all across the globe just to ask him questions and have their questions answered by him. Now the title for Ecclesiastes means the preacher or the one who assembles others. Ekklesia is the Greek word for the church in the Bible. It means a called out assembly. So this is very similar to it. And so it received the name Ecclesiastes. So title means the preacher or assembly. There's kind of a threefold theme for this book. Number one, the book is a search for satisfaction. A search for satisfaction. Church, somehow I knew that would get a laugh out of me. The theme of this is a search for satisfaction. And this satisfaction is found nowhere under the sun. When you just consider the earth and the earth's atmosphere, this satisfaction is found nowhere under the sun.
Part of the same one.
Second part of the theme is what philosophers would call the absurdity of life without God. The absurdity or the futility of life without God. You examine everything under the sun and you don't put heaven in the equation, life does not make sense. And the third portion of this theme is that true satisfaction is found only in God. True satisfaction is found only in God. So the theme of this word is a search for satisfaction, and the satisfaction is found nowhere under the sun. This book teaches the absurdity of life without God, and that true satisfaction is found only in God. An outline of Ecclesiastes is five parts to this. Number one, life under the sun is vain. Life under the sun is vain. That's chapter 1, verses 1 to 11. Life under the sun is vain. Part 2, Solomon seeks satisfaction under the sun. And we'll take a look at that in a little while. Solomon seeks satisfaction under the sun. And the four or six words there start with an S. So. Part three, Solomon seeks God's purposes in everything. That, by the way, is chapter 3, verses 1 to 12. The rest of chapter 1 and chapter 2 are in the second section. Fourth section, Solomon grieves for all that is under the sun. That goes right down to the end of chapter 11. Solomon grieves for all that is under the sun. And Solomon's conclusion is found in chapter 12 of Ecclesiastes. So let's take a look at the first section. Life under the sun is vain. For the word vain, I'll give you a few of closely related words. They're, if not synonyms for vain, it means that life under the sun is useless, futile, absurd, nonsense, and frustration. Vain means that life is useless, futile, absurd, nonsense, and frustration. Life without God. These, by the way, are the same types, even though despair in there. These are the same types of words that modern existentialists use. They teach that if there is no God, there's no meaning to life, and they assume that there is no God, so hence, there is no meaning to life. And they end up wallowing in the mud of despair, or they decide to take the existential leap of blind faith into the non-rational realm and try to create meaning for their lives. Some existentialists are. Others, though, because of that leap of blind faith, they're, you know, creating meaning and, you know, whatever. Just go out there and actualize yourself. As Jean-Paul Sartre says, it doesn't matter whether you help the old lady across the street or mug her and take her money. As long as you actualize yourself, you gave meaning to your life. You see, man, I don't want to get into existentialism, but it's existence precedes essence. In other words, you don't come into life with a basic nature that all men share, so you're defined already. You create your own definition of what you really are, and so you got to actualize yourself. Take a look at the first 11 verses. Says the this is life under the sun is vain. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem, vanity of vanity, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What advantage does man have in all his work which he does under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. Also the sun rises and the sun sets, and hastening to its place it rises there again. Blowing toward the south and turning toward the north, the wind continues swirling around, and on its circular courses the wind returns. All the rivers flow into the sea, if the sea is not full, the place where the rivers flow, there they flow again. See, Solomon's, even his science causes him to despair because nothing really makes much sense. It's just a cycle going over and over again. Verse 8, all things are wearisome. Man is not able to tell it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor is the ear filled with hearing. That which has been is that which will be, and that which has been done is that which will be done. So there is nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which one might say, see this? It is new. Already it has existed for ages which were before us. There is no remembrance of earlier things, and also of later things which will occur. And there will be for them no remembrance among those who will come later still. And so it sounds pretty pessimistic, saying that life under the sun is vain, useless, futile, absurd, nonsense, and frustration and despair. When he says life under the sun, what he's saying is when all you look at in the equation is the earth, life on earth, and the earth's atmosphere, and you don't put heaven and God in the equation, life without God is absurd. So then Solomon begins to seek satisfaction of the sun. So now he starts to look in different places. And he says, in fact, look at verses 17 and 18. And I set my mind to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I realized that this also is striving after the wind. Because in much wisdom there is much grief. Increasing knowledge results in increasing pain. The more you learn about life, the more wisdom you get, the more bad you view it, the sadder you become, and the more despair you wallow in. Chapter 2, verse 2. So wisdom is vain. He also says laughter is vain. Look at verse 2. I said, of laughter it is madness, and of pleasure, what does it accomplish? Verse 3, he says, wine is vain. I explored with my mind how to stimulate my body with wine, while my mind was guiding me wisely in how to take hold of folly, until I could see what good there is for the sons of men to do under the heaven a few years of their lives. Now, he's going to draw all of these to a conclusion that's still a waste of time. Building projects are vain, verse 4. I enlarged my works, I built houses for myself, I planted vineyards for myself. Wealth is vain, verse 8. Also I collected for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I provided for myself male and female singers and the pleasures of men, many concubines. So music and woman, wealth is vain, music and woman. Our vain is multiplying sexual partners, and music, and wine, and wealth, all these things are vain. Recognition is vain, verse 9. Then I became great and increased more than all who preceded me in Jerusalem. My wisdom also stood by me. Again, he brings his wisdom into the situation. Verse 10, worldly pleasures are vain, and all that my eyes desire, I did not refuse them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure, for my heart was pleased because of all my labor, and this was my reward for all my labor. And then verse 11, thus I considered all my activities which my hands had done and the labor which I had exerted, and behold, all was vanity and striving after the wind, and there was no profit under the sun. So he sums up, he seeks satisfaction under the sun through wisdom, laughter, wine, building projects, wealth, music and woman, recognition, worldly pleasures, and he finds that everything is vain and useless under the sun. Verses 15 to 17, then I said to myself, as is the fate of the fool, it will also befall me. Why then have I become extremely wise? So I said to myself, this too is vanity. For there is no lasting remembrance of the wise man as with the fool, inasmuch as in the coming days all will be forgotten. And how the wise man and the fool will alike die. So I hated life, for the work which had been done under the sun was grievous to me, because everything is futility and striving after the wind. But then, Solomon in verses 1 to 12 begins to see the purpose to life. He begins to see God's purposes in everything. Okay? So take a look at verses 1 to 12 of chapter 3 of Ecclesiastes. There is an appointed time for everything, and there is time for every event under heaven. A time to give birth and a time to die. A time to plant and a time to uproot what is planted. A time to kill and a time to heal. A time to tear down and a time to build up. A time to weep and a time to laugh. A time to mourn and a time to dance. A time to throw stones and a time to gather stones. A time to embrace and a time to shun embracing. A time to search and a time to give up as lost. A time to keep and a time to throw away. A time to tear apart and a time to sew together. A time to be silent and a time to speak. A time to love and a time to hate. A time for war and a time for peace. What profit is there to the worker from that in which he toils? I have seen the task which God has given the sons of men with which to occupy themselves. He has made everything appropriate in its time. He has also set eternity in their heart. Yet so that man will not find out the work which God has done from the beginning, even to the end. I know that there is nothing better for them than to rejoice and to do good in one's lifetime. Moreover, look at verse 13 too. Moreover, that every man who eats and drinks sees good in all his labor, it is the gift of God. You see, what he's saying here is there's a time for everything. Everything fits into God's purposes, God's purpose for life and all. But then he says that the reason why we cannot find satisfaction under the sun is because God has set eternity in our hearts. Let's say that you wanted to find satisfaction in life from your career. Well, that's going to cause you, no matter how much you love your career, that's going to cause you to despair. Why? Yeah, someday you're going to die and you can't take your career with you. You can't take your wealth with you. You can't take your wife with you. You can't take your kids with you. God has set eternity in our heart. Anything short of eternal joy will cause man, if he dwells on it enough, and if he really thinks it to its logical conclusion, will cause a man to despair.
Now, when you say you can't think your wife and your kids, you mean that they won't be your wife and your children. Hopefully, they'll come with you to heaven eventually, but they'll no longer be like a family.
Yeah, that's even an honest issue. I'm talking right now just considering everything in this life.
Okay.
So, in other words, if we're just looking for happiness in this something in this life doesn't last forever. No matter how good a good thing is, it's going to end when you die. And so God set eternity in our hearts. And so the only way we're going to really find true satisfaction in life is if there is some type of eternal joy, eternal peace, eternal happiness. And so God, we're created in God's image, and God set eternity in our hearts. Solomon grieves for all that is under the sun, starting in chapter 4. Look at verses 1 to 3. Then I looked again at all the acts of oppression which were being done under the sun. Behold, I saw the tears of the oppressed, that they had no one to comfort them. And on the side of their oppressors was power, but they had no one to comfort them. So I congratulated the dead who are already dead more than the living who are still living. But better off and bold in them is the one who has never existed, who has never seen the evil activity that is done on the sun. So he goes back and forth. Everything's true till under the sun, then he brings God into it. And then he goes back, he's just thinking about life. And here he's saying tyranny and oppression. And poor man being put down by the evil rulers. Verses 4 and 5. And I have seen that every labor and every skill which is done is the result of rivalry between a man and his neighbor. This too is vanity and striving after the wind. The fool folds his hands and consumes his own flesh. One handful of rest is better than two fists full of labor and striving after the wind. And he talks about our need for friends in verses 9 to 12. Verse 9, two are better than one because they have a good return for their labor. But if either of them falls, then the one who will lift up his companion, but woe to the one who falls when there is not another to lift them up. Furthermore, if two lie down together, they keep warm, but how can one be warm alone? And so it talks about the advantages of having friends. Verse 16 of chapter 4, there is no end to all the people, to all who were before them, and even the ones who will come later will not be happy with them, for this too is vanity and striving after the wind. Talking about kings there, even kings will be forgotten. Look at chapter 5, verses 14 to 16, and then verse 19. When those riches were lost through a bad investment, and he had fathered a son, and there was nothing to support him, as he had come naked from his mother's womb, so he will return as he came. He's quoting that from Job, or paraphrasing from Job. He will take nothing from the fruit of his labor that he can carry in his hand. And this also is a grievous evil, exactly as a man is born, thus he will die. Thus will he die. So what is the advantage to him who toils for the wind? Verse 19, furthermore, as for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth, he has also empowered him to eat from them and to rejoice, and to receive his reward and rejoice in his labor. This is the gift from God. So he's talking about the fact that God has given us a gift to enjoy these riches, but if we really dwell on them, look at verse 20, for he will not often consider the years of his life because God keeps him occupied with the gladness of his heart. He's even feeling sorry for the rich guy because the rich guy doesn't see his need. The rich guy doesn't see that the life isn't really all that it's perked up to be. And he may die rejoicing, not realizing that he's going to lose it all. Chapter 7, verse 20, that reads, indeed, there is not a righteous man on earth who continually does good and who never sins. And so he's making it real clear, no man is just. Verse 29, behold, I have found only this, that God made men upright, but they have sought out many devices. God created man perfect, but man has fallen. That's just good, solid theology right there. Chapter 9, verses 2 and 3. It is the same for all. There is one faith for the righteous and for the wicked, for the good and the clean, and for the unclean, for the man who offers a sacrifice and for the one who does not sacrifice. As the good man is, so is the sinner. As the swearer is, so is the one who is afraid to swear. Verse 3. This is an evil in all that is done under the sun, that there is one faith for all men. Furthermore, the hearts of the sons of men are full of evil, and insanity is in their hearts throughout their lives. Afterwards they go to the dead. Verse 5. For the living know they will die, but the dead do not know anything, nor have they any longer a reward for their memories forgotten. See, he's just looking at things from the earth standpoint, and he's saying, what a waste of existence. You can be a good guy or a bad guy, you're both going to end up in a pine box. You're both going to end up with your loved ones weeping and wailing, because you're going to die whether you're good or whether you're bad. There's a little practical advice here in Ecclesiastes 11, verse 2. Divide your portion to 7 or even to 8, for you do not know what misfortune may occur on the earth. You don't know what's going to happen, so invest your money wisely. You can't predict the future. And hopefully, if you're invested in real estate and real estate goes down, maybe you're invested somewhere else where that's going to go up. So he gives some practical advice throughout this book as well. But Solomon's conclusion is found in Ecclesiastes chapter 12. Look at verses 6 to 8. Verses 6 to 8. Remember him before the silver cord is broken and the golden bowl is crushed. The pitcher by the well is shattered and the wheel at the cistern is crushed. Then the dust will return to the earth as it was, and the spirit will return to God who gave it. Vanity of vanity, says the preacher, all is vanity. So he's saying, remember God before you die. Look at verses 13 and 14. This is Solomon's conclusion of this book. A very tough book to understand. But once you understand Solomon's conclusion, the rest of the book begins to make sense. Verses 13 and 14 of Ecclesiastes chapter 12. The conclusion, when all has been said, is fear God and keep His commandments, because this applies to every person. For God will bring every act of judgment, everything which is hidden, whether it is good or evil. Is everything under the sun makes no sense at all until you consider God in the equation. So make sure you remember God before you die, because this is a test right now. And therefore, the conclusion after everything has been said, fear God and keep His commands. That is where the meaning of life is wrapped up in. And that will bring wholesomeness and nice up to life. Otherwise, life makes no sense. Now look at Proverbs chapter 9 and verse 10. We looked at a passage that was very similar to this, said the same thing when we went over Proverbs. Proverbs chapter 9 and verse 10 says, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and the knowledge of the Holy One is understanding. That's the theme. The main theme of Ecclesiastes is the fear of healthy fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. You'll never understand the meaning to life if you just continually examine things under the sun and try to find true satisfaction and try to find true happiness apart from the God of the Bible. That's why Sigmund Freud's views aren't going to help you, and Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle missed the mark.
What's that?
Darwin, right on down the line. Unless we get in a right relationship with the God of the Bible, through faith in Jesus Christ, nothing else makes sense. Life is totally meaningless. And so Solomon is saying, life under the sun, life without God, is vain, useless, futile, absurd, nonsense, brings nothing but frustration. It's meaningless and ends up in despair. Life is totally absurd without God. True satisfaction is only found in the God of the Bible. So that's the book of Ecclesiastes. The Song of Solomon, the next book. And you don't have a lot of time to cover it, but that's pretty good anyway, because it can be a pretty juicy book at times. The author is King Solomon. Look at chapter 1, verse 1. The Song of Songs, which is Solomon's. So King Solomon wrote this. written before his death, obviously, 931 B.C. Most authors write their works before they die. The theme of this book is basically the love of Solomon for his Shulamite bride. Love of Solomon for his Shulamite bride. A Shulamite is a young Palestinian woman. A young woman grew up in the land that is now Israel, though she was a Shulamite, not an Israelite herself. The theme is literally the love of Solomon for his Shulamite bride, the love of a husband for his wife. It's kind of ironic because he has so many other wives as well, but his love for her is portrayed here, and it illustrates Christ's love for the church. Look at Ephesians 5, verses 31 and 32. Paul's talking, he says, "This mystery is great, but I'm speaking with reference," "For this cause a man shall leave his father and mother, and shall cleave to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. This mystery is great, but I'm speaking with reference to Christ and the church." Every marriage is supposed to represent the relationship of Christ and the church. The church is the bride of Christ. The church submits to Christ. A wife should submit to her husband. Christ loves the church enough to die for the church, and the husband should love his wife enough to die for his wife. And so this relationship here, the love of Solomon for a Shulamite bride, illustrates also Christ's love for the church. Now Solomon was guilty of polygamy. We find it in this book, in the Song of Solomon, chapter 6, verse 8. We don't have time to turn there. 1 Kings 11, verses 1 to 3. Tell us that Solomon had a total of 1,000, when he had his wives and his concubines together, all the women that he was having sex with, was 1,000 women. And so Solomon was guilty of polygamy. Still, God used him to write a beautiful poem of monogamous love, of one man's love for one woman, despite all the garbage that was in his life. You know, don't ever get a big head because God can use you. With Balaam, the false prophet, God spoke through a donkey to give him a message. And, you know, God could speak through a jackass. Yeah, he can use me, and but that's no reason for me to get a big head. It's not the messenger that has the power, it's the message that has the power. But God used a polygamous, sinful guy like Solomon to write a beautiful poem of monogamous love. But, you know, quite possibly, he might have been the only man qualified to write this. It might have been that a guy who had every woman you could possibly want had 1,000 women, and saw how empty that was in comparison to the love that he had for this one woman. Maybe that's what caused him to see how a true relationship should be. But God still used this guy to write a poem of monogamous love. Outline. And, you know, this is the craziest outline I've ever written in my life because it's not in order. But it was written kind of like a play. Containing this part, this chorus is being sung, and it's literally all over the place. The outline, I'm following the storyline, but the storyline doesn't follow an order. Okay? Solomon had a vineyard about 50 miles north of Jerusalem. He was the king, okay? But he had a vineyard about 50 miles north of Jerusalem. Chapter 8, verse 11 talks about that. Solomon had a vineyard at Baal Hamon, and he entrusted the vineyard to caretakers. Each one was to bring 1,000 shekels of silver for its fruit. So he had a vineyard about 50 miles north of Jerusalem. Now, the rest of the information falls under that, and then we'll get to the second section. I don't want to give away the story by giving the entire outline. But he had a vineyard about 50 miles north of Jerusalem. The vineyard was rented out to a family. The family was made up of a mother, two sons, and two daughters. That's mentioned in chapter 6, verse 13. Here's the Shulamite woman is mentioned there, her beauty. let's see, where's Luke 13? They talk about their sister in chapter 8, verse 8. I don't feel like reading it right now. A mixed company. But the Shulamite woman, she was a beautiful young lady. She was hardworking, but had no time to care for her personal appearance. The story's kind of in some way, like, almost like the ugly duckling. Even though she was a beautiful woman, she was very young. Chapter 8, verse 8. They explain she had not filled out yet, and because of that, some people, some of her relatives looked down upon her, but she was hard working and had no time to care for her appearance. Look at chapter 1 and verse 6. Do not stare at me because I am swarthy, for the sun has burned me. My mother's sons were angry with me. They made me caretaker of the vineyard. She's working hard. She's getting real dark from the sun. Has no time to care for her appearance. But she's very tanned by the sun. But Solomon had his vineyard, and his family is there, and this girl is a member of his family, and she's very beautiful, a Shulamite, even though she had no time to care for her personal appearance. But she's a very lowly girl. She's not wealthy at all. Now, a mysterious shepherd visits the Shulamite, and the two fall in love in chapter 1, verse 7. Tell me, O you whom my love... This is chapter 1, verse 7. Tell me, O you whom my soul loves, where do you pasture your flock? So a shepherd comes to her, she falls in love with him. Where do you make it lie down at noon? For why should I be like one who veils herself beside the flocks of your companions? So they fall in love, and this mysterious shepherd visits the Shulamite woman. The two fall in love. He leaves her but promises to return. And while she is very comfortable to read, while he is away, she has two dreams. Chapter 3, verses 1 to 4, she dreams that they are married, and then she awakes and finds him gone. Let me see. A lot of this stuff has to be censored before you read it. In fact, take a look at verse 1. The first time I taught on this, it was at a Bible Sunday school class. Everybody here knows Cease, right? And Cease is the bookkeeper for the church. She's a grandmother that's in the church, very nice lady. But I said, if I started, I purposely did not put down any of the juicy verses. I didn't want to embarrass anybody. And so I said, okay, the author of this work is King Solomon. Cease, if you could read chapter 1, verse 1. Well, in most Bibles, there's no number 1 next to the first verse, and her eyes are getting a little bad. And so she accidentally skipped down and read verse 2, and she read it like this. May he kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is better than wine. And everything got dead quiet. Real quiet. And then I remember what my old professor Morrison at Liberty University, whenever you would read the wrong verse, he would always say, I was blessed. You know, so after C said that, there was dead silence, and then I said, I was blessed, and then everybody started laughing, and then Dave D'Amato spent the whole study finding the juiciest verses and just started reading them out loud, and we almost kicked him out of the study because he was fogging up the windows over there at the union hall. But if anybody knows Dave DeMott, he's a man of tremendous class. But anyway, while he's away, the shepherd's away, the mysterious shepherd lover that she has, she dreams that they're married, and she awakes from her sleep and finds him gone in chapter 3, verses 1 to 4. On my bed, night after night, I saw him whom my soul loves. I saw him but did not find him. I must arise now and go about the city in the streets and in the squares. I must seek him with my soul, him whom my soul loves. I saw him but did not find him. The watchmen who make the rounds in the city found me, and I said, have you seen him whom my soul loves? Scarcely I have left them when I found him whom my soul loves. I held on to him and would not let him go until I had brought him to my mother's house and into the room of her who conceived me. So she's having these dreams that they're married. She awakes and finds him gone. Then afterwards, now he returns. One of the dreams, he returns, but she opened the door after he left once more. Chapter 5, verses 2 to 6. We don't have time to read that, really. Then in chapter 3, again, this is all in different order. It's very hard to decipher. You have to really study this book close to figure it out. But in chapter 3, verses 6 to 11, King Solomon visits the small city. Okay, so this woman has, now this is not a dream. This is beyond her dream. So, you know, Solomon, he had his vineyard about 50 miles north of Jerusalem. A family's there, and a beautiful young lady who worked real hard and had no time to keep up her personal appearance. The sun is making her real, real tan. But a mysterious shepherd visits the Shulamite. The two fall in love, but then he leaves her but promises to return. He leaves her, the shepherd, and he promises he's going to return. Well, then in chapter 3, verses 6 to 11, King Solomon visits the small city. So he comes from Jerusalem and visits the small city. What is coming up from the wilderness like columns of smoke, perfumed with myrrh and frankincense, with all scented powders of the merchant? Behold, it is the traveling coach of Solomon, 60 mighty men around it, of the mighty men of Israel. All of them are wielders of sword, expert in war. Each man has a sword at his side, guarding against the terrors of the night. King Solomon has made for himself a sedan chair from the timber of Lebanon. He made its post of silver, its back of gold, and its seat of purple fabric, with its interior lovingly fitted out by the daughters of Jerusalem. Go forth, O daughters of Zion, and gaze on King Solomon with the crown with which his mother has crowned them on the day of his wedding and on the day of his gladness of heart. So all of a sudden, the big king, King Solomon, visits the small city. Look at chapter 4, verses 7 and 8. King Solomon visits the small city and he asks to see the Shulamite woman. Now she's shocked. She's tremendously surprised. Why would the king want to see her? And she's even more shocked when she recognizes him as her lover. She sees that the shepherd, the King Solomon, is in fact the same one as the shepherd, the mysterious shepherd who visited her before, and the two had fallen in love. And so in verses 7 and 8, chapter 4, the king comes for his bride, and he takes her away and makes her his bride. You are altogether beautiful, my darling, and there is no blemish in you. Come with me from Lebanon, my bride. May you come with me from Lebanon. Journey down from the summit of Amana, from the summit of Senir and Hermon, from the dens of lions, from the mountains of leopards, and he takes her to be his bride. There's a lot of... The book is just a beautiful, probably the most beautiful love, piece of literature of love between two people ever written. And there's a lot of beautiful verses, such as the description of the Shulamite woman, chapter 1, verse 8. If you yourself do not know most beautiful among women, go forth on the trail of the flock and pasture your young goats by the tents of the shepherds. But she is called most beautiful among women. Verse 15 says, how beautiful you are, my darling. How beautiful you are. Your eyes are like doves. Chapter 2, verse 2. Lily, a lily among the thorns, so is my darling among the maidens. And it goes on and on. Chapter 4, verse 11. Your lips, my bride, drip honey. Honey and milk are under your tongue, and the fragrance of your garments is like the fragrance of Lebanon. Obviously, this guy is attracted to this woman. Chapter 2, verse 1. I am the rose of Sharon, the lily of the valleys. Description of Solomon is given in chapter 5, verses 10 to 12. She says, my beloved is dazzling and ruddy, outstanding among 10,000. His head is like gold, pure gold. His locks are like clusters of dates and black as a raven. His eyes are like doves beside streams of water, bathed in milk and reposed in their setting. Streams of water. The key I want to leave with, we're running real low on time here, though, is this is literally a love story between Solomon and one of his wives. The love of a man from God. There's the sanctity of the sexual union between a husband and his wife. This is a thing of beauty, and this book speaks to that primarily. However, that is the interpretation of it. The application of it applies to Christ and his relationship with the church. Think about that. A mysterious shepherd visits her and falls in love. Leaves, promises to return. And then when the king returns in all his power and glory, she finds out that the king was the shepherd who she loved so much. And so obviously you see there, in there, in this love relationship that Solomon had with the Shulamite woman, you also see a type of the relationship of the love of Jesus Christ and his bride, the church. Jesus Christ, he is our shepherd who cares for us and takes care of our needs. But he is also, in the second coming, he's promised to return, and someday he will return as King of Kings and Lord of Lords to take his bride to be with him forever. By the way,